Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, What's New in Metastatic Prostate Cancer. And there's a lot of information. You're going to hear a lot of things that are new, and it's a wonderful time to be offering this program for all of you. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 527 participants, and you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities and rural and suburban areas and frontier communities as well. And we also have international participants from Belgium, Canada, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world and truly a group of information seekers. Now, today's program was made possible by an educational grant from Santa Fe Adventist US LLC, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. We have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to turn your attention for a moment before we start the program point out the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there are outlines that our speakers have prepared, areas they're going to cover, and there also is information about all of the different collaborating organizations as really a resource for each of you to access information and help. There also is an evaluation form, and I really would ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. And we have, for those of you who have received a paper packet, we have included a postage envelope, a post-free envelope. So very much would like your feedback and your thoughts about today's program, and it really helps us as we plan future programs. You know, your recommendations really determine the programs that we offer in the future moving forward. Indeed, a program on metastatic prostate cancer is one that many of you have asked us to offer. And so, again, it's an opportunity for us to hear, to have a dialogue with you and a feedback from you about what you think about the program and what you'd like us to do moving forward. Now, we do have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Susan Slovin. Dr. Slovin is Associate Attending Physician, Genitourinary Oncology Service, Sidney Kimmel Center for the Treatment of Prostate and Urologic Cancers, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She's also Associate Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin is going to provide an overview of metastatic prostate cancer. She's going to address understanding new treatments, the role of clinical trials, and also she's going to talk about communicating with your healthcare team about all your treatment options. I now turn this program over to Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's always a pleasure to try to update everybody in a very short period of time on some of the new treatments and innovations that are taking place in medical oncology as it pertains to prostate cancer. I've been asked to focus mainly on metastatic prostate cancer right now, and I guess the most important thing is to discuss what we mean by metastatic disease. When we talk about cancer that has spread beyond the confines of the prostate, either when the person is newly diagnosed or after they have received primary therapy such as surgery or radiation, and the cancer can now be seen on a bone scan or on a CT scan, that is what we mean by metastatic disease. But you're going to hear another terminology that doctors often use about people having what we call micrometastatic disease. And what that usually refers to, again, is somebody who has had surgery or radiation, and they have an elevated PSA, indicating that they have failed their primary therapy, but probably have cancer cells floating around in their bloodstream. And we really can't see any disease on scans as yet, because it's very, very early on. So we use these terms usually to explain that the cancer is no longer confined to the prostate itself, but this does not necessarily mean that this is going to impede anybody's future treatments and that your survival in any way is compromised. In fact, people do very well for many, many years. For patients who have disease that has metastasized or spread outside the prostate, whether it's to the lymph glands or to bone, the standard of care has been and continues to be hormonal therapy. Many of you know the different names by which hormonal therapy is known, Lupron, Zoladex, Trelstar. They're really from a class of drugs known as GnRH agonists. And what they technically do is that they interfere with the signal from the brain to the testes or the male gonads, which produces testosterone. And over a period of time, the testes no longer obtain a signal from the brain to tell them whether to continue or not to continue making testosterone. And when that happens, patient will go through the equivalent of a male menopause. Hot flushes, mood swings, loss of libido, loss of sexual function, some fatigue, mood swings, hot flushes, as I've mentioned before, everything that you see in women who may be going through menopause. Now, understand that this is not a female hormone. It's really a drug that interferes with the chemical system, or signals, in the brain that goes to the testes to make the testes produce testosterone. It's well tolerated. We often sometimes give a pill, which is called an anti-androgen, really a drug that interferes with the testosterone that is momentarily surging through your bloodstream upon the cessation of testosterone being produced. There's always a little bit of testosterone in the bloodstream first, and when the communication between the brain and the testes is lost, the testes sometimes will make a lot more testosterone momentarily to try to get the attention of the brain and literally tell the brain, here I am, what do you want me to do, shut off or continue. The two together are called combined androgen blockade, meaning that you are stopping production of testosterone through interfering with the signal in the brain, and you're stopping testosterone from interfering with the growth of the tumor cell in the body itself. There are many different names by which these drugs go. There's, as I mentioned, Trelstar, Lupron, Zoladex. They are standards of care, and whether you use one or the other makes no difference. More recently, a new drug has been approved called Degerelix. That's a GnRH antagonist, and for patients who need immediate cessation of their testosterone, this drug will work immediately. And again, it's really up to your urologist to help you decide whether or not one is better than the other. I think it really makes no difference. It really depends on the clinical situation. Should your hormones no longer work for you and your cancer does not go into a remission, meaning that the PSA does not go down to zero and that the cancer cells, whatever has been seen on your scans, do not disappear, there are other drugs that can be used. In fact, we've learned over the course of many years that you can respond to a variety of different hormonal manipulations. For example, if your cancer has responded to a combination of an anti-androgen and a GnRH agonist over a period of time, and all of a sudden the PSA starts to rise, just by changing the anti-androgen, you can actually continue to have your cancer respond. So what we used to call hormone refractory disease is not really longer any more refractory to other agents within the same family. And so very often it's not uncommon for patients to have gone through two or three different manipulations of these pills along with the GnRH agonist or the injection that allows us to maintain a very long treatment response. Now, if the cancer does no longer respond to the effects of different hormonal manipulations, we are very fortunate to have several new hormonal drugs that are just come into FDA approval. I would mention first that very often patients are told that they must go on to chemotherapy immediately as a result of failing hormonal therapies, and I would say that that is not the norm. In fact, the reason for people to go on chemotherapy is varied. The three indications that I use is if somebody's PSA is doubling or tripling so quickly that giving additional hormonal manipulation would not be reasonable. Another indication would be that somebody has a what we call failure to thrive. They just don't feel well. They're not eating. They're losing weight. They just have some lassitude, and chemotherapy may be more reasonable for that patient. And the third is if somebody has metastatic disease that is progressing so rapidly that the amount of radiation that one would have to give that patient may compromise the bone marrow reserves. And in that situation, chemotherapy can improve quality of life, improve pain control, spare the marrow, and we also already know that chemotherapy can improve survival. So what else can one do if one were not going to do chemotherapy? Well, we have a variety of different medications out there now. I'm very pleased to say that we have just received approval by the FDA for a novel drug called abiraterone, A-B-I-R-A-T-E-R-O-N-E. This drug will not be commercially available likely for another 2 months or so, but it's a drug that works not in the conventional manner of the antiandrogens. It works at the level of the adrenal glands, which are two very tiny little bean-shaped organs, one atop each kidney. And it works on the chemical machinery within the adrenal gland that produces estrogen and testosterone. So this drug is an oral medication and has been shown to reduce the PSA and impact on the disease for patients who have failed other hormonal manipulations. There's another drug currently in clinical trial called MDV-3100 that's similar to Casodex, which is an antiandrogen, but works from a completely different mechanism. This drug is also oral and also has shown significant impact on not only PSA, but also on bone and CAT scans. For those patients who are still not ready for docetaxel, again, talking to the healthcare team of your medical oncologist, radiation oncologist, even your urologist, it's very important to get different perspectives on what you think would be questions that have to do with your disease. And I want to reassure people that we all work together. That it is always part of the routine of our care for our patients to at least let the doctors who are involved in their care, whether past, present, or future, to be aware of what's going on and how it may impact their interaction with the patient. You may have all heard of a new treatment, an immune therapy called Provenge by the Dendreon Corporation. This was recently FDA approved as well. And it really is the removal of your own white blood cells, which are exposed to a protein in the laboratory. It takes about 2 days, and then they're given back to you intravenously. It has been shown to improve survival in a manner comparable to chemotherapy by about 4 months, but does not have as dramatic an impact on quality of life, PSA, or even changes in bone or CAT scan as does chemotherapy. Nevertheless, it does have a role in your care. What about clinical trials? Well, clinical trials should always be evaluated as a potential treatment any stage during the disease. I mean, I know many oncologists work with industry, pharmaceutical companies, the National Cancer Institute, to bring novel treatments to the public. And remember, these are not drugs that have never been seen or heard of before. Many of them have their roots in the laboratory. They are used either on novel schedules or in combination with biologic agents and have an answer a scientific question. We always feel, at least I feel, I should say, that it is always very beneficial early in the disease to consider investigational trials for one reason, and that is that you may, in fact, impact on the biology of the cancer very, very early on. For those patients who need to go forward with a much more aggressive therapy, docetaxel is the standard of care as a chemotherapy drug that's given every 3 weeks by vein. It's been shown to improve quality of life in addition to survival, can impact on the PSA. And I don't want people to think that giving chemotherapy, it means that it's an end-stage disease and you're dying. It has nothing to do with that. You can give chemotherapy, and we do so investigationally early on, sometimes prior to chemotherapy. We can give it early in the middle. We can give it later on. And so it really depends on how things are going, at which point your doctor will be recommending docetaxel. Good news is that we have a new third drug, Gemtana. The other name for it is cabazitaxel, which has now been FDA approved in the second-line setting for patients who have failed the standard chemotherapy docetaxel. So all these are just new and very, very exciting drugs that I think are really impacting on people's quality of life and what we can now offer to patients. We also, in addition to giving these novel drugs, are looking at protecting the bone. And we, again, now have a new drug, denosumab, in addition to a drug called Zometa, which are bone protectants. And what they do is they delay the time to a patient developing what we call a skeletal event. And that skeletal event can be a hip fracture. It could be what we call a cord compression, which is the impact of your cancer within the bone pushing on the cord. Or it can be just a loss of height of the vertebrae that can come from osteoporosis, for example. Now, the FDA had approved denosumab a while ago for its use in postmenopausal women with osteoporosis who were at high risk of fracture. It's a little different than Zometa, which is a drug from a family of drugs called bisphosphonates. This one is a monoclonal antibody or a protein that's directed to a particular molecule in a signaling pathway. And this drug has substantial affinity and specificity for a particular target called RANK. It interrupts the cascade of molecular events that can lead to bone metastasis. Both of these drugs are appropriate. They can be used depending on the clinical situation. It's not that one drug is better than the other, but there are clinical indications for one over the other. So while I'm afraid I'm just giving you a very brief overview of what's out there, I think this has been a banner year for prostate cancer, meaning that we now have abiraterone approved, we have Provenge, we have Gevtana. There are wonderful clinical trials with novel agents that may impact on the biology of the cancer. And as I said before, a lot of these clinical trials can be used or are available at different clinical states of the disease from very early on to later in the disease. And I think everybody has more than enough reasons to be extremely hopeful about the future, given what we have to offer. So I'm going to turn everything back to Carolyn and offer my thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Slovin, for just doing a very comprehensive and incredibly informative presentation and encyclopedic and covering so many different areas. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Michael Zalewski. Dr. Zalewski is Professor of Radiation Oncology, Chief Brachytherapy Service. He's also with Department of Radiation Oncology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Zalewski is going to address the role of radiation oncology in treating metastatic prostate cancer. He's going to talk about managing side effects and pain and quality of life concerns. Dr. Zalewski?
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and it's also a real pleasure for me to be here on the line to talk to you all about the role of radiation therapy in the management of metastatic prostate cancer. Certainly, radiation therapy has a well-known and established role in treating primary prostate cancer, which is the disease prior to it has having been metastasized, and it is often a very effective treatment, similar to what it can be achieved with surgical approaches as well, now that there are so many new technologies. But radiation has had a long and a well-established role in the management of metastatic disease. And this is where very often the disease is lodged in the bones, sometimes within lymph nodes causing symptoms, or within the spine. And for many years, we've known that radiation therapy, often in a course of 10 sessions directed at the area of the metastatic deposit, could be very effective in terms of relieving discomfort, shrinking the disease down, and improving the symptoms. And this long and established role is well known to oncologists and urologists, because in situations where the disease is in the bone, very often patients are referred, even if they are on hormonal therapy because of associated pain, to receive radiation therapy, focal radiation treatments directed at the lesion, which in about 60, 70% or even 80% of the time can achieve a significant relief of pain. And for that very reason, patients should, if they have any kind of discomfort, especially in a particular area, they should bring to the attention of their urologist, medical oncologist, the fact that they do have this discomfort, and to potentially receive a very effective therapy in terms of reducing pain. I would have to say as well that there have been some very important technological innovations and significant improvements in the way radiation therapy is given for prostate cancer, and in particular to these metastatic sites. We've seen now with the advent of what is called stereotactic radiosurgery, where very high radiation doses given with exquisite accuracy down to the millimeter or less than that can focus on areas of these metastatic deposits and give high dosages of the radiation in very tight and contoured delivered doses to this area. And because we're treating to a really a smaller region, a much more targeted way of delivering the radiation, we've seen less side effects. And what's very interesting as well is that we have seen more significant reductions of the tumors in the areas we treat. You know, there are certain kinds of tumors, even outside of the family of prostate cancer. We've treated tumors that have been metastasized from the kidney, which are notorious for not even being so responsive to radiation. And we have observed very high rates of the tumors really dissolving as a result of the very focused high-energy radiation that we give. And so we recognize as well that when it comes to metastases from prostate cancer, we've had experience, and many other institutions have now emerging experiences using stereotactic radiosurgery or pinpointed radiation to give, instead of 10 treatments or 15 treatments, one treatment or even three treatments in some situations to achieve the delivery of a high radiation dose in a short period of time. It's not only more convenient, but we're now seeing that about 80% of the time, to the areas we treat, those remain quiescent and not regrow. And then the management challenges would be continuing with the oncologist, and that is continued chemotherapy, as Dr. Slovin eloquently talked about, or continued different forms of hormonal therapy. And that, of course, takes care of the systemic problem. I think oncologists certainly have for many long periods of time have recognized that careful use of radiation treatments as focal therapies, as spot treatments, where we could so-called spot weld areas that are being active or breaking through the chemotherapy treatments or the hormonal therapy treatments, could be very, very effective as well. There are side effects associated with the treatments we are talking about, and in general, these are short-term side effects, often resolving after a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. They include sometimes, ironically, a flare of pain after the treatment, which probably is a manifestation of some inflammation related to the radiation, which can be actually often prevented with the use of some steroids before the radiation is given. And that pain generally resolves, and as mentioned before, if there were pain prior to the treatments, in about 80 to 90% of the time, the pain is significantly reduced, if not completely eliminated. Fatigue is also a side effect associated with general with radiation treatments. And we have to keep in mind that when people have had hormonal therapy, or especially chemotherapy, which affects the bone marrow and the ability to produce enough of the red blood cells, and sometimes because of the disease itself, making it difficult to produce an adequate amount of the red blood cells, causing an anemia, radiation on top of these treatments can further lower the blood counts, and thus it is important for the radiation oncologist and, of course, the oncologist to continue to monitor blood counts during the course of therapy and after the course of therapy, or that is radiation treatments, to ensure that these counts remain stable. Of course, side effects from radiation depend upon where you're aiming the radiation at. If the radiation is aimed near some of the intestines, then there could be a temporary inflammation of the intestines, which sometimes could cause diarrhea or cramping. And in general, when patients have pain in the bones and they're getting directed focal radiation treatments to these areas, there's an important balance that needs to be taken under consideration with the pain medications that you may be on and the radiation. If the radiation becomes very effective, then a gradual tapering of those pain medications would be appropriate and needs to be managed by your radiation oncologist or urologist. We know that rapid removal of pain medications could be dangerous, and therefore this should be done in a careful and monitored setting with the guidance of your physicians. Finally, I would talk about the role of quality of life with treatments, and I've alluded to this already. Because of the availability of these targeted forms of radiation, not only is it effective in terms of reducing the symptoms of pain, but we've seen that it's very effective in improving the quality of life of the individual patient. Less pain, obviously, is associated with that. But we as oncologists need to be often careful and really working together with the patient in terms of anticipating possible manifestations of the metastases, which could cause pain down the road, but not yet now. And in some situations where the pain, for instance, is or the disease is lodged near the spine, but not causing pain, which we call epidural disease, disease that is near the spinal canal, which if left untreated may continue to grow and press on nerves and cause neurologic compromise. This is where it may be important to deliver preemptive strike, so to speak, or prophylactic treatment to ensure that this disease does not progress and cause those neurologic problems which could happen without therapy. And therefore, once again, careful oversight by the oncologist with the appropriate imaging studies such as an MRI or similar kinds of studies are very helpful to guide these kinds of therapies. So in summary, what we've talked about regarding radiation today is that radiation has a long and established role in the management of metastatic disease, in particular for the management and palliation of pain associated with bone metastases. While traditional therapies have been used, which consist of a course of 2 weeks of daily therapy, we now have, in specialized cases, stereotactic radiosurgery options which can deliver very focused and high-energy radiation in three or even one session of radiation. We talked about some of the side effects associated with radiation today, which are generally limited and managed often either with medications or just with time. And we talked about the balancing that needs to be taken into account with the side effects of the pain medication as well as the side effects associated with any of the treatments. In particular, constipation could be an issue with some of the pain medications, and therefore a careful balance and oversight of the dose of pain medications a person is taking is very important. And finally, all of these important improvements have made an important impact as well on the quality of life of the patients that we are treating. Thank you very much for your attention today.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Zaleski, again, for just an excellent presentation and just really for covering both the details of the radiation treatments that are available for patients, but also in terms of addressing many of the side effects and pain issues and quality of life issues that are so daunting to people, and just giving a lot of very important information to everybody. So thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Neil Shah, and Dr. Shah is Director, Carolina Urologic Research Center, Atlantic Urology Clinics. And Dr. Shah is going to talk about the importance of your urologist, your oncologist, your radiation oncologist, and your primary care doctor working together. I now turn the program over to Dr. Shah.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. You know, I think it was said earlier very, very eloquently by Susan, what a great year 2010 was, and how 2011 is now starting off to be another tremendous year of advancement for patients with prostate cancer. And this can't be overstated. You know, for years we've had a lack of viable quality treatment options for patients who failed their surgery or failed radiation for their primary disease. And in 2010, we saw the U.S. FDA approve three new drugs for the treatment of advanced prostate cancer. And in all of 2010, the FDA approved a total of 22 new drug therapies. So three of the 22 were in advanced prostate cancer. A tremendous year, and already, as Susan said yesterday, we had another oral agent approved for advanced prostate cancer. And what's even more exciting is we have a half a dozen other remarkably robust agents, both intravenous and oral, that are pending, and even new radioisotopes that Dr. Zaleski alluded to, all to continue to with the goal of making advanced prostate cancer a chronic disease state so that patients no longer succumb to prostate cancer. And invariably what we want everybody to pass on to is old age. So it's a great time in treating patients with advanced prostate cancer because of the plethora of new therapies. It's almost an embarrassment of riches. But what that leads me to, and I think what Carolyn wanted me to address, was the importance of communication by all of the caregivers, especially the urologist with his medical oncologist and the radiation oncologist. And it's important for patients to understand this because with this burgeoning new information, a lot of it has not really percolated out to everyone who treats advanced prostate cancer. And part of that is understandable. Everyone's very busy now. We see more patients. There's a manpower shortage of radiation oncologists, urologists, medical oncologists. We see more patients, less time. There's economic constraints, which everyone's aware of worldwide. So I think it's incumbent upon both the patient as well as the caregiver team to maximize their communication. So collaboration by the urologist, medical oncologist, and radiation oncologist is so essential for patients to get the best care that they can get. Because quite honestly, with all of these new breakthroughs, within our advanced prostate cancer team, we don't always know right now the best sequence, the optimal combinations. We're working through that now. So that's somewhat of a challenge. But at the same time, it's a great challenge to have. We have all of these new therapies that have been approved and new ones that are on the cusp of approval in the next few years. And also, I can't stress enough the importance of making sure that you have access to quality clinical trials in centers that understand the importance of clinical trials. Dr. Zaleski, Slovin, and myself have spent a career promoting and involving our patients in clinical trials, because it's only by doing so and by getting patients throughout the world to understand the importance of clinical trials that we've been able to make these great breakthroughs in making prostate cancer a chronic disease. And not only therapies that add life to patients, but also quality of life, which is extremely important. We're all in the process of always looking for better therapies, less invasive therapies, and more tolerated therapies. So having the urologist who may have begun treatment with surgery and or instituted hormone therapy, it's very, very important that that urologist speaks to his medical oncology colleagues, his radiation oncology colleague, as well as now the primary care physician, because we're learning more about the importance of nutrition, exercise-related therapies, and even things that we borrow from, you know, the Eastern world in terms of relaxation techniques and even over-the-counter therapies. We have to be careful about making sure that patients are protected against sham or undocumented therapies. But we can learn more about other therapies other than traditional prescriptive therapies. So it is a true team effort. I think it's an incredibly exciting time. I think we all have a great stake in making sure that we continue to make advanced prostate cancer the treatable disease that it can be. And it is incumbent upon all of us to communicate better. And I think as patients and those who are listening and caregivers who are listening, it's important to find a center, find a physician who understands that collaboration and integrative care is ultimately the best care. So I'll stop with that and open it up for the questions from everyone.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Shore. A very, very excellent presentation, and importance of the collaboration is so important, perhaps now more than ever. So thank you for really highlighting that. That's so important. Thank you. And now we do have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring all of our speakers on board. If you don't get to ask your question or you think of a question after today's program, please do call us at 1-800-813-HOPE. We have a staff of social workers here, 60 master's level trained oncology social workers who are here to answer your questions. So if for some reason you don't get to ask a question or you think of a question when the program ends, don't hesitate to call us. But now let's take as many questions as we can. Mary, can you explain to everybody how to queue up for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Emil S.
Yes. Do I still need a urologist even after I've had a robotic surgery to remove my prostate and the cancer comes back? Or do I just go to an oncologist and not deal with a urologist anymore?
Thank you for that question. Dr. Slobin, could you address that question?
That's an excellent question. I have patients who ask me that quite a bit. As we've all said before, it's very important for us to have communication with one another. Very often, patients who have a biochemical relapse may be treated with hormonal therapy, if appropriate, by their local urologist, or they may seek that, if appropriate for them, with a medical oncologist as opposed to their urologist. The other reason to stay in touch with the urologist is if you do have problems as a result of your surgery, problems with urinary incontinence or bleeding, or you've had prior radiation, you've had some issues, I think it's always very good to touch base. Some urologists like to see their patients yearly just to make sure that they're in the loop. Other patients might just prefer to use their ancillary doctors, meaning the radiation oncologist or the urologist, on an as-needed basis. So I don't know that there's really a right answer there. I would defer to Dr. Shore for his opinion on this.
Dr. Shore, would you also like to comment on this?
Yeah, it's a very, very changing time right now. Again, there, as Susan says, there's no simple answer. If you have a GU medical oncologist like Dr. Slobin, who is dedicated to all of the most recent cutting-edge therapies in GU oncology, that's the perfect medical oncologist. Likewise, if you have a urologist who is up to date not just on local primary therapy, but also on patients who have failed with PSA relapse or biochemical failure, then you're going to get very good care. The key is making sure that you have that particular medical oncologist or urologist who really is up to date and is following the best treatments for PSA relapse, for castrate-resistant prostate cancer, be it asymptomatic or symptomatic. You'll see now over and over again referencing to the changing landscape of systemic therapy. And the best part about that constant motif is getting all medical oncologists and some urologists to embrace all of these new therapies. And I think so, again, the patient has to make a decision based upon that urologist who did the robotic surgery. If he or she is interested in taking care of biochemical failure and some things beyond biochemical failure, then it may be a good choice. And if not, that urologist should be very quick to get the patient to be seen by a medical oncologist.
Excellent. Excellent question and very thoughtful answers. Thank you so much. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Joel N.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm concerned about all the new treatments and therapies that have been approved and all the new ones that are going to be coming online in reference to how are we going to know how they need to be sequenced. I know that the FDA approvals are specific, but I think over time we'll find that drugs can be used at different periods other than when the original approval. How does this process happen?
Excellent question. Dr. Slovin, do you want to?
Yes, that's an excellent question, as Carolyn just said. You're right. It's over time, number one, but remember that before we take these drugs to different times in the disease course, we actually do clinical trials in that particular clinical state of the disease to make sure that the drug is actually efficacious there. So while some of the new drugs have been approved for patients who have failed conventional hormones, for example, or have failed chemotherapy, there are clinical trials that will examine the same drugs in a much, much earlier state to see if there's any benefit to introducing them earlier than the current indications. So it is done logically. It is not done haphazardly. There is a method to the madness of drug approval. And we don't like to use something unless it's indicated for that particular clinical state. So the long and short of the answer is we have to wait it out, and we have to wait for the trials to show that there is efficacy there.
Excellent. And do any of our other speakers wish to address this? Okay. Thank you, Dr. Slovin. Excellent. Okay, our next question, please.
Our next question comes from William K.
Hi, Darren.
Yes, William. Now,
yes,
your question.
For Susan. You spoke when you talked about shoring up bones from metastasized prostate cancer with Zometa, and there was a new alternative, and I think I heard it, Dosamet, but I think I misread that because I can't find anything about that online. Dosamet. What was that alternative for metastasized?
Yeah, it's not really an alternative. It's just another drug that's been FDA approved. It's called denosumab, D-E-N-O-S-U-M-A-B. The other name for it is Xgeva, X, I think, E-G-E-V-A. And if you just put in denosumab, it'll pop up as Xgeva. And, each one is used appropriately. It's just a matter of whether or not there are medical reasons for you to be changed from one to the other, but they both work appropriately in delaying the time to skeletal events, which is really what we care about.
And do you think that are there any the discussion with one's physician in terms of which protocol one uses would be very important for tailoring?
I think you're right. I think in many cases it's really the decision of the physician that will determine how to proceed. Some patients may have abnormal kidney function, which may preclude that they not get one drug but get another drug. Or there may be transportation issues, which precludes the patient coming in a particular schedule. So there's this should be freely discussed with your physician. Some doctors may feel that one is more advantageous than the other. And again, this is completely transparent, and I would suggest that this be discussed between you and your physician.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Melvin M. Melvin, if your line is on mute, will you please unmute?
Okay. Thank you. A question about robotic surgery and then a PSA that has been elevated over the last 6 months, went 0.01. Now this month is 0.03. And when should I get concerned about the elevation number and what number?
Melvin, thank you for that excellent question. I'm going to ask our speakers to address your question in a general way. I'm going to ask Dr. Shore if he would address this question, and then Dr. Slovin as well. Yes. Sure.
So when patients have their PSAs checked, we've made some big improvements in terms of looking at different types of assays. There's normal assays and what some describe as ultra-sensitive assays. And the decision to treat a biochemical recurrence depends on many, many different factors. It depends upon the primary mode of therapy, whether it was a surgery, a removal, whether it would be open procedure or robotic. It depends on what the baseline PSA was. It depends upon the patient's final pathology report. And similarly with radiation, it's a different paradigm, and I'm sure Dr. Zaleski will want to discuss this and how to interpret PSA follow-up. What's important is understanding that instituting a therapy based solely upon one lab test, one simple blood test such as a PSA, is not done in a vacuum. The treatment team, and this is, again, another opportunity for medical oncology, urology, and radiation oncology to talk with each other to decide what would be the best therapy, if any therapy at all. We have been historically accused in the United States, the urology community, of maybe over-treating or over-utilizing hormonal therapy, and I think it's not an unfair accusation. So we need to understand what the data is to institute hormone therapy, possibly to institute additional adjuvant radiation therapy in the setting of a failed surgical procedure. And we also have very, very good clinical trials looking at biochemical failure, too. So I would say that one has to truly individualize the Melvin's question to that particular person's overall health history and what are the options available, and the whole entire team from an interdisciplinary standpoint needs to answer it in a careful and thoughtful way.
Thank you. And Dr. Slovin?
I echo Dr. Shore's statement. I would point out that if one really were to look at definitions, what is considered to be a biochemical failure or a failure of the effectiveness of prostatectomy is a PSA of decimal 0.1. Now, that being in and of itself abnormal, because your PSA should be at zero, I really don't give a lot of credibility to PSAs that are 0.01 or 0.02. We start to get a little bit more concerned at 0.1. But keep in mind that sometimes you can have PSAs that stay at the 0.11, 0.12, and back down to 0.1 level, and it can be due just to some normal prostate glands that may have been left behind that secrete a little bit of PSA. However, if you see that your PSA continues to rise, it's a little bit more concerning. So I agree with Dr. Shore. We have to take it under advisement and, again, look at the sensitivity of the assay. Some of them are so darn super sensitive that you can't read them because you think you're literally having higher values than you would or lower values than you would expect. And that's why you want to check your PSA at the same institution or facility each time.
Dr. Zaleski, did you want to include something in terms of the issue around radiation?
Sure. You know, In situations like this, I would agree with my colleagues that you can't make a decision based on one value and often and sometimes not even two values. But if you see a consistent rising trend, then you have to take into account some of the features on the pathology, and sometimes this will trigger certain tests like scans, a bone scan, or the like. And in some situations, the team, the treatment team consisting of the oncologist, radiation oncologist, urologist, will be putting their heads together. And if the consensus is that this rising PSA possibly is representing microscopic disease and disease that is, let's say, confined to where the prostate used to be, as in Melvin's question, then in those situations, we know that focused radiation treatments can be a very effective and the preferred treatment intervention at that time, possibly before any other treatments like hormonal therapy. So I agree it shouldn't be a rash decision. It should be a decision based on probably several blood tests in conjunction with your treating physicians.
Awesome. Thank you. And here you see the whole team really, Melvin, trying to help you to think this through and, of course, to direct you back to your treating healthcare team so that you can have this discussion about all the specific details of your particular prostate cancer. Thank you so much. Thanks. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from David D.
Yes. Is there a role for the drugs that Dr. Slovin mentioned in treating bony metastasis being used earlier to help prevent the spread to the bone?
That's an interesting question. Dr. Slovin?
The new drugs that are currently on the market are really for patients who have metastatic disease. They actively treat the disease. To my knowledge, there are no data to support their use in prevention per se, because first of all, there's a big side effect profile for some of them. And number two, we don't have any data that it actually interferes with disease progression early on, because very often we just don't know when someone's disease is going to progress. So just to give it prophylactically and have people undergo side effects without any data to the effect is just not going to be worthwhile. So the answer is we don't have that data yet. It could very well be that some of the pharmaceutical companies are investigating it, but they don't have the same mechanism of action that we would look for in a preventive type of cancer, anti-cancer agent. That's the best I can answer right now, unfortunately.
Thank you. Okay. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from John P.
Yes. You mentioned going on new drugs after you fail the standard hormonal stuff, and you gave three reasons why you wouldn't do that. Could you elaborate on the doubling that you mentioned, or did I understand you correctly?
No, what I had mentioned was the rationale for going on to chemo, and I used three indications for when I would use chemotherapy. Now, if you failed hormones, you can go on to an investigational trial, and there are some newer hormones that are possible options for you. But the three reasons that I personally use for somebody to go on to chemotherapy would be someone whose PSA is doubling or tripling so rapidly that I just can't control it on a variety of different hormonal therapies. The second is a patient who is just not feeling well, they're not eating, they're losing weight, what we call failing to thrive. And the third would be someone who has rapidly progressive metastatic disease that's very symptomatic, causing pain. And while we often use the services of Dr. Zalewski to treat symptomatic disease that's in bone, sometimes the amount of radiation and the field of the radiation, you know, the expanse of the radiation that would be needed may be just so much that we would be perhaps sacrificing some of the bone marrow reserves. And the benefit of using chemotherapy either before in lieu of or even after the radiation would be to try to spare the marrow, improve the quality of life, and also derive an anti-tumor effect. And so sometimes it's better to use chemo before you do radiation therapy, but of course every clinical situation is very different. Excellent. I hope that was helpful.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question?
Our next question comes from Herb S.
Hi, doctors. How does one differentiate between metastatic problem with bones and arthritis or anything like that?
That's an excellent question, Herb, and I'm going to ask Dr. Slovin to address that.
You bring up an excellent point, and I think one of the biggest concerns we have is the bone scan. And the bone scan is a imaging modality that's really based on the presence of phosphorus, technetium pyrophosphate. So it's phosphorus that literally is radioactively labeled with a contrast agent. We know that there are many things in bone that cause it to change, what we call bone turnover. And among them is degenerative arthritis, inflammation, infection, as well as cancer. So a bone scan is not specific for cancer. Technically, it's really more for bone turnover. And it's really the radiation, the nuclear medicine physicians who, looking at the pattern and the clinical history, are really able to tell you whether or not what you're dealing with is metastatic disease in bone. There are other benign conditions, such as Paget's disease, that has a very distinctive appearance if you were to do a CAT scan of the bone. Sometimes we're really not able to call it one way or the other, and we might do something called a PET scan, proton emission tomography. The reason for that is that it looks at metabolism of bone, meaning the activity within the bone itself as the bone starts to grow. And we know that cancer cells take an abnormal form of sugar and utilize it compared with normal cells. And using this imaging modality, we are able to determine what is due to cancer and what is due to just benign changes within bone. So that's really some of the modalities that we would use. And again, it's really clinical expertise in looking at the scans and also knowing the patient's history that will assist you in making that kind of discriminating decision.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank all of our speakers today. This has really been an extraordinary call, an amazing call. Our speakers have been outstanding, and they do represent the whole multidisciplinary team. And all of you have been excellent in asking such great questions that really allow our speakers to further elaborate on concerns that you may have. I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour education program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour workshop. And so I do want to bring you back to the fact that although the workshop will end soon, the services that you can access from cancer care, those are endless. And I want to just give you a quick update on what those are. We have a staff of 60 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services for each of you. We offer practical and financial assistance, and we actually have very generous financial assistance grants in terms of transportation for treatment. Some of you may be struggling with transportation issues, so please do take advantage of those services as well. We also offer assistance with just counseling services, someone to talk to about your concerns and issues, so definitely do contact our staff. We offer a number of different support groups, both on the telephone and online, and many people find being in a support group to be incredibly helpful as a network of support. We also have many materials, both booklets and fact sheets, that you would find invaluable. And we, of course, offer many of these workshops. Usually we offer a couple a week, and you can actually go to our website. You also have in your materials information about upcoming programs that we have that might be of interest to you. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with cancer, with prostate cancer, with metastatic prostate cancer. I want you to feel that you're now part of a community of support, Cancer Cares Community, and that you can contact us at any time for help, and we are here for you. And again, our number is 1-800-813-HOPE. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.